Hey, this is Michael Emery. Thanks for tuning into the Slow Baja. This podcast is powered by Tequila Fortaleza, handmade in small batches, and hands down, my favorite tequila.
Slow Baja is brought to you by the Baja XL Rally. The Baja XL is the largest and longest amateur off-road rally on the Baja Peninsula. It's 10 epic days, LA to Cabo to LA. Check it out at BajaXL.org. I am delighted to be here at Baja HQ with the legendary Cameron Steele. And we are upstairs in the conference room, sitting well apart from each other at the conference table, wearing a couple of masks, as Cameron's got a new baby at home. So we're taking some precautions. If we sound a little muffled, that's what's up. Cameron Steele, thank you so much for making some time for Slow Baja.
I'm stoked to be here. I mean, I love the name All Alone. That's the first thing that hooked me. And then, you know, anybody that's friends with Jeff Hill at Baja Bound Insurance is a friend of mine for sure. So I'm stoked to be here with you.
Well, before I get into your accolades, I'm going to humble brag right here that Jeff told me when I interviewed him that in 2006, I was the first sponsored racer for Baja Bound Insurance.
He told me the very same story. Yeah. When he called me about setting up this podcast interview, he told me that, and I was like, oh, that's really cool.
Well, enough about me. So I'm going to just read something here that really, really stopped me in my tracks. Because I know about you more from your at-large reputation than I do as the human behind the reputation. So this just stopped me in my tracks. In the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame 2018 induction, so you are in the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame, which is amazing because you're young and you're still alive. They said in the induction, long before social media, Cameron Steele was doing social media. He is one of Off-Road's early crossover pioneers, sharing his love for desert racing, adventure travel, and all things Baja with the world outside of the off-road community. The legendary Johnny Campbell calls you Baja's biggest ambassador. It's a pretty serious compliment from a pretty serious racer.
That is very serious. And you know, that night I didn't get to hear that, so it's interesting to hear it transcribed. I mean, I heard it, but my head was rolling around a little bit trying to figure out how I was being inducted into the Hall of Fame. But you know, for me, my love of Baja is deep. My love for the people is equal, and I think that the respect level that they show to us and we show to them is key about making that magic happen. It's a majestic place because of how everybody interacts there.
Well, take me back to Mark Big Daddy Steele. That's a hell of a nickname for your dad. Mark Big Daddy Steele. Tell me about your dad and your earliest Baja trips.
He was an imposing figure. You know, he passed away, unfortunately, 2 years ago at 82. He is a big man, 6'5". When I was in high school, he was probably around 350 pounds. So there was a gangster movie out at the time, and there was an imposing figure called The Fixer. So one of my buddies started calling him The Fixer. But then later on, Big Daddy just kind of seemed to fit. And, you know, my dad loved Baja. I believe he first went in the 50s. I can't be sure. But I know the very first race he went to, he was the general sales manager, I believe, for Parnelli Jones. And Parnelli knew that my dad flew an airplane or had an airplane. And he invited my dad to be his pilot for the race in 1970. So I believe that's the third year that the race ran, maybe the fourth. And my dad was there and flew for Parnelli. And I just recently found those photos in some of our family's historic photos. We were trying to save stuff from water damage and found those. But my dad went with Parnelli in 70, and in 71, my dad was on the start line in a Class 1 car, and he never left. And I was born, I don't want to date myself too much, I guess, but I was born in 68, and by the time it was 72, my dad was bringing my brother and I to Baja, my brother born in 71. So, you know, our Baja experience started before we can even remember. You know, and funny story, people always ask me, what's your first memory of Baja? And everybody wants to say, you know, it's like that glorious beach day or the wave you caught or the beautiful Cardones or something. But I totally remember the trash burning because that was really prevalent, driving through Mexicali to a race. And I remember throwing up out of the family motorhome. That was my first experience. But my love affair has grown deep and wide since that day. And my dad introduced us to that magic and never left. My dad was fully committed all the way until his death, going to Baja. It was him racing from 70 until about 92, I think, maybe. No, I'm sorry, 89. My dad probably raced his last race. And I started racing in 82 as a navigator and 85 as a driver. And my dad kind of stepped aside in the late 80s to let me take that helm, so to speak, for the family part of the racing. And, you know, we raced until my mom was diagnosed with cancer. And she ended up battling for 5 years, but our family didn't race in that time. And then I went back and have never left. I mean, it's really, it's almost like a two-part relationship with Baja. It kind of had like a stopping point when my mom died, but then it reignited in 2000, and it's been really spectacular ever since.
Well, I'm amazed that you were there so early, and I too share some of your memories. I'm a couple years older than you and started going to San Felipe mainly when I was in college at San Diego State. And that first trip over in 84, driving through Mexicali and just smelling that, for me, that was the smell of Baja, unfortunately. And, and luckily, you don't smell that anymore. But that smell of,
yeah, you do.
That smell of burning trash.
Depending on where you're at.
Yeah. Well, I just got back, and I didn't have to smell it much. Outskirts of Tijuana, you smell that burning trash a little, but it just didn't. It was just the sensory smell in those days. Of course, we were driving with our windows down.
Yeah.
You know, didn't have air conditioning. Right. Yeah. So you're just smelling it a lot more. It's a lot more visceral.
Interesting side note to that, and I'd say yes, you do vibrantly. But that's only because, you know, if you race the Peninsula Run on the Baja 1000, somehow SCORE finds a way to take you through every trash dump at every city. Like, you come in or out of the town through the trash dump. So every once in a while, you get that burning trash smell.
Well, we'll get back to the burning trash smell here. But let me tell me about your early days. You grew up here, San Clemente, right?
I did.
San Clemente High School. You worked at the Pico 7-Eleven.
True.
Yeah, true.
True.
All right. Competed in 6 pipeline bodyboarding world championships. Is that true?
True.
Come on.
No, it's real. When I was a youngster, my dad was kind of a little bit of a wanderer. He wasn't really a guy that was set in school type of thing. He never went to school. You know, he was driving a truck by the time he was 14, a logging truck, nearly died from rheumatic fever when he was 12. And so he never went to school. So my dad had a passion for getting out and doing things and doing it himself. And he became a car salesman. And, you know, everybody jokes about car salesmen, but it gives you a great aptitude to do whatever you want. And my dad was like, you know, you got to go to school, but do what you're passionate about, basically. And so my dad, you know, while a lot of families weren't dropping their kids off at the beach or the pier where I grew up when they were 10 or 11, my dad was doing just that. Mom. And I got to start riding waves, and I had a group of friends, and the bodyboard had come out, and for some reason, you know, I was surfing and bodyboarding, but a friend of mine named Ki Sasaki from Hawaii encouraged me to stay with bodyboarding, and next thing I know, my first real career outside of 7-Eleven was riding bodyboards, being paid to surf the competitions and travel Amazing. Around. Yeah, kind of the world, but more really specifically the United States, Hawaii, Puerto Rico. And yeah, what a great experience, you know, being able to represent the mainland. At the time, they did it in segments for the world championship. It wasn't just straight qualifying. So you had to qualify for your area. And for me, I was a California qualifier amongst a couple other guys. But it was a great experience. And I still have friends from those days that I still ride waves with. And although bodyboarding has been at times looked down to from surfing, I've always maintained my status as a bodyboarder, and I love it to this day. I mean, I had to take my bodyboard out of the car this morning. I went to Aliso to take my dog for a walk, and always bring my board in case the surf is cracking.
There you go. Well, that's I think that authenticity is authenticity in your approach is what. Is the reason that no one has anything bad to say about Cameron Steele. There are two people I found in Baja that you just, everybody widely loves and has good things to say, and that's you, and seemingly Kurt LaDuke seems to be the other one.
He knows a guy.
He knows a guy.
That's his quote.
I don't think Kurt LaDuke is much of a bodyboarder,
You want to hear a true Kurt LaDuke story?
I do.
Really quick?
I do.
Kurt LaDuke had never surfed before, and we were on trail of
missions. Not surprising.
We're on trail of missions, and I told Kurt when we got to San Juanico, Scorpion Bay, I'm like, Kurt, you're going to surf. He's like, I don't surf. I don't go in the water. I'm like, Kurt, put your swim trunks on and let's go. Well, he didn't have swim trunks, so I was pushing him into waves in his underwear. But so I'm behind him pushing him in. You get the visual, right? But Kurt got a wave, and his wife, Kimmy, got her first waves in San Juanico, and it's a huge treat for me. I think that I totally understand people not having anything bad to say about Kurt. He's just very genuine.
Yeah.
And he and I get along great. We're a little bit different. You know, he's an East Coast guy. I'm a West Coast guy. You know, he's a little bit more, I would say, tempered in his demeanor. I'm a little bit more outgoing. But Kurt's pretty wild and outgoing also. But we're a great team. And we spend a lot of time on our trail missions trip together. We always invite Kurt to be a part of that. And really, any media we do, we try to link him in with. But he's an exceptional human being.
Yeah, I managed to get into the inaugural run of the Nora 500 safari class that Kurt was leading. And I was in my 71 Land Cruiser. So it's, you know, four modern vehicles and my old Land Cruiser.
Yeah.
And I think they were just wondering, like, what's with this dude? Soft door, soft top, no windows, pith helmet, bench seat, three-speed. You know, 30-inch tires, no suspension. And Kurt could not have been nicer to me. I mean, he could have big-leagued me all day long, and he couldn't have been nicer. And really, he said, here's a radio. We're going to wait for you guys at every turn that you could miss. And I didn't think anybody was going to be babysitting us. But I felt like I had to check in with my mom, you know, my mom and dad. Like, Kimmy and Kurt, I think we're genuinely, like, let's make sure we don't lose that guy.
Yeah.
I don't know what's up with that guy, but let's make sure
right.
I'm responsible for him and I'm not going to lose him.
I think, yeah, he's just a great person. I mean, that Baja has those people, you know, there's some amazing people all over the peninsula, but Kurt is definitely one of those transplants that comes there, fits right in and knows how to share the stoke. That's kind of what I say, you know, share the stoke is our tagline for Baja HQ, yeah. But it means more than that. It's not just a tagline. It's how we feel and how we live, and Kurt definitely is super good about that.
Yeah, he was terrific. Hey, tell me about the trips. You already touched on the Trail of the Missions. Tell me about those trips and your Baja family.
Well, you know, first of all, we're not a tour company, so we're not cultivating people. Not to say that we don't ever bring any new people, but we do. But I never wanted to be in the tour business. Lots of people think that's something that we should do, but I have a couple of very specific trips that we do. We work with the Mexican government on it, build some media around it, and we have just an amazing time. And I think because it's not a job, you don't ever have to look at the bottom line. And it's been great to be able to share that majestic Baja with people that, you know, maybe would have never gone if they didn't feel like they had a little bit of a security blanket with us or with Kurt or with our medic, or, you know, we have a pretty big ensemble of people. But you know, we've traditionally hosted three motorcycle trips a year and a couple of truck trips a year, which we are still doing. Trail of Missions is our flagship. The Monster Energy Trail of Missions, presented by BF Goodrich. Sorry, got to get sponsors in there. But they deserve that honor because they believed when no one else was, like, making media in Baja and no one else was doing anything, they're like, well, you think you can do that? Then go ahead. Let's see it. But that's just an amazing trip. You know, it's so fun with the kids and taking people that have never been. I mean, people that are, and even people like Johnny Campbell, who's an off-road racer, who's seen the race course a million times, taking him on the trips and taking him to other places they haven't been before because there's no reason to be there. So our flagship motorcycle trip is called Rip to Cabo. It's kind of a weird name, but that was what we came up with when we started doing it. We're in our 16th year, I believe. So not too long, but we've been doing that for a while. And then we have a trip called Baja Beach Bash, which is a motorcycle trip where, along with Baja Bound Insurance and all of our other partners, we work to raise money for the orphanage at Rancho Santa Marta. This year, we didn't get to have the trip out of respect. We decided not to go. And we still were able to raraise nearly $150,000 for the orphanage.
Yeah, online, virtual, which was a pretty amazing achievement.
There's some phone calls in there. I might have leaned on a few people here and there. People know the call's coming sometime in June or July. But the off-road community really opened up their arms, and a couple really significant efforts. Blaine Dunn from Colorado, who'd never been to Baja, was touched by going on Baja Beach Bash. He now raises, he has his own fundraiser to put into ours for the trips, and he raised $25,000 all by himself. And Brian Beatty's foundation also did the same. And so it's really cool to see people just fall in love and be able to share it. And then we have a couple other smaller trips, Truck and Good Times, Surf and Turf, and we have a dirt bike ride that's a really tough ride called Hell Ride. I think the name pretty much sums it up, but just riding the hardest of the hard stuff, lots of rocks in Baja. But that's pretty much our adventure traveling down there. And then we also try to offer to our group an international trip each year. I know Mexico's international, but it's North America, so not really. I consider Mexico and the United States and Canada kind of all one. But we've been to Iceland and Costa Rica, Portugal, and we were going to Costa Rica again for the second time last year, and Australia, but both trips got canceled because of the travel bans, obviously, and we don't want to travel with respect to other people if, you know, there's people that are sick.
Yeah. So sharing the stoke is utterly legitimate. I'm going to stop anybody who now is going to say, I'm going to email Cameron at Baja HQ and see if I can get on his next trip. You're not running a tour company.
You're not
looking for business. You've got the folks that are going with you. Just let's be clear about that, because I don't want to create grief for you.
It's okay. I don't mind people emailing us. We don't have space. We never do. We have brought some new people now and then on some of the different trips, but they usually find their way to us as friends of friends or someone that's vouched in or something like that. But we don't advertise and we don't cultivate online. But if anybody has questions, you know, they can always ask. But we're not looking for more people, but we're excited to share the visuals that we put out there with people so they can see how epic it is.
It is pretty epic.
We did a series called BF Gritter's 50 Best of Baja, and I gathered a group of Baja know-it-alls together, and we all picked our top 30. Then we combined them to find out what was the top spot or favorite spot. It's pretty crazy that, you know, there was a lot of, in that group of 10 people, there was probably over 100 places that were chosen, although we compressed it down to 50. But there's so many different places to love and see and touch and people to get involved with. And I mean, that vibe is alive south of the border, and Baja is just a spectacular place.
Well, I just talked to some folks who had driven an old Land Cruiser from Tecate all the way down to Tierra del Fuego and back.
Wow.
And
massive.
And they're still living in the truck and driving around the United States. And I said, you know, tell me about some of your favorites. And they said, you know, Baja. And it's so funny. We tried to kind of rush through Baja because we had a lot more travel and we'd been to Baja before. But that central coast, you air down. There's nobody at those beaches. Or if they are, they're going to bring you a lobster or a little something, you know, some fish. And you've got just so much of the country to yourself. And it's right here on it's desolation on our doorstep.
It's really amazing. I think that, you know, you can travel all over the world, which I have done pretty extensive amount of traveling. And it's really hard to find any place. You know, California is spectacular, but you head down to Mexico, into Baja, and again, the people are what make it. But you get out into that desolate part of the land. I mean, the landscape, the ocean, the sea, the mountains, the cactus, the flora, the fauna. I mean, if you take time to look at it, it is just absolutely shocking. And people are like, ah, it's a desert. It is not just a desert. It is amazing is what it is. I mean, and people have a hard time, but then you get people that come from other countries that, you know, have never been to Baja, and they see it and they're just like, oh my God, this place is amazing. And, you know, I traveled around the world as a commentator also in one of my other professions. And, you know, people could ask you about anything, right? I worked at Supercross. I worked at X Games. I, you know, traveled all around. Everybody wants to ask you about the Baja 1000. Everybody wants to ask you about Baja, no matter where you go, no matter who it is.
So we're going to get to the Baja 1000 in just a second. I want to ask you, since we're of similar age, I recently was out in Riverside and got to talk to Malcolm Smith. Where does Malcolm Smith live to a serious racer like yourself? I mean, where is he in the, You know, if you're looking at baseball players, is he Willie Mays?
He's definitely, I mean, whether he's Willie Mays or Babe Ruth or, you know, just one of those super iconic people that, you know, went and did it with a smile on his face and shared it. I think that Malcolm is the epitome of what that American that is touched by Baja and then returns to share that stoke, whether it's fundraising for those less fortunate in Baja, whether it's taking people there and sharing it with them, or success in racing, whatever it is. I really regard Malcolm highly. I've gone on Malcolm's trip here in Saboba, motorcycle ride. I haven't spent a ton of time with Malcolm. I met his son Alexander when I think Alexander was still in high school. We were down pre-running, and Malcolm's like, "Hey, you know, meet my son." And it's an honor to know that be able to see how Malcolm has done what he's done and see his love for the peninsula. So we hold Malcolm in the highest regard.
Yeah, I think that Malcolm's apple may have fallen pretty close to San Clemente as I sit in here and talk to you and hear about what you're doing. But let's get right into it. Baja 1000. Can you describe
She's
it?
She's tough.
Can you describe it? I mean, is it the Le Mans 24 hour? Is it Indy? Is it... you know, the greatest of NASCAR races all rolled into one. What is it like? And what is it like to have the terrain, the challenges of the machine and the terrain and the man and the violence? Break it down for me.
I don't know if I can break it down any better than you did, but I would use a different analogy. It's like seeing that woman that's so amazing, that just is so spectacular to you, and getting to know her and spending that time to build that relationship, and eventually you get married and you have this like kinship, and it's just, it becomes glorious, right? And that's kind of Baja. I mean, it's tough. It's, you know, being married is one of the toughest things anybody can do, and anybody that's married knows, you know,
25
it's
like, years.
You know, I've been married for 22 years, and it's not always easy, but it is glorious. And I think that that's kind of how the Baja 1000 is, right? It's so beautiful, right? You, from the outside looking in, people are like, that's the race I want to go to. Well, let me tell you, that's the hardest race you're ever going to take on, because it's so remote. It's always changing. There's no pit stops that are easy to get to. There's one paved road down the peninsula, and you're going to be bouncing around out there. It's just, for people that have never been, you know, you talk to in passing, like, you know, down the street or whatever. Oh yeah, you know, I'm gonna race the Baja 1000. You're like, oh yeah, but what other races have you done? Oh no, I've never done anything. I'm just gonna race the Baja 1000. You're like, holy crap, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into. But that's the beauty of it. You know, SCORE has opened it up so anybody can compete basically. There's no real requirements other than safety requirements, and there's so many different classes. But for me, Baja is a historic, legendary, beautiful, just pain in my ass. You know, it's like I grew up going there, grew up racing there. I was fortunate to win in a limited car at the Baja 1000 in 2003. We've had some other success, but had never won the big dance overall with the trophy truck. And, you know, that was one of my dad's most interested in things. For my dad, one of the things my dad would be the most stoked about, he passed just before, but having our family's name in that overall four-wheel category, because when my dad was younger and racing, he was racing for that overall category. Later in life, he couldn't really afford or get the team together to do that. He raced in limited classes, but I think my dad would be so stoked to see our name there, and I'm so right there with him. That is such a stellar thing. And honestly,
can you dive into that a little bit? You brought your dad with you.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you talk about that.
No, I mean,
it's in print.
Sure.
I don't know, you know,
no,
if you're comfortable,
good.
Just to tell us a little bit about that specific year, that specific run, your dad riding with you and the challenges that you, met and overcame and your mindset that carried you the whole way.
Well, I actually goes back a little bit. In 2017, I was kind of maybe had enough, and my family was growing with my daughter Kay, And I told my wife and daughter and my dad, you guys travel to La Paz. It's a peninsula run. It's a legendary run.
It's 50th anniversary.
50th anniversary. We're going to win this race, basically. I had no doubt in my mind we were going to win that race. We had won the Nora Mexican 1000 earlier that year. Our engineering by Mike Kraft had been spectacular. My teammate had been killing it. We in the year 2 years before, we had finished third overall on the peninsula run. And we went into that race knowing we felt like we were going to win. And, you know, I was going to get there and I was going to go up on the stage with my daughter in my arms. And I was going to say, I'm all done. You know, we win the race. We're going to leave. And shit, we got second. And I knew we could do it.
Mm.
And, you know, there's this, you get the checkered flag and 40 seconds later, you're at the talking on the microphone, you know, and my wife's there, she's crying, I'm crying, she hands me my daughter, my dad's there, I pull up on the podium, my wife's there with me, and in those 45 seconds I had to decide if I was gonna, you know, if I was leaving with second place or if I was gonna stay. And we decided to stay. And unfortunately my dad would pass in July of 2018, so 6 months later, 7 months later, my dad would die, 8 months later. My dad would die, and I just knew that we had to finish this quest. And right after my dad died, we had not won a SCORE Trophy Truck race, but in September we won the Tijuana Desert Challenge. I was like, damn, we just won a SCORE race in Trophy Truck. That's really great accomplishment, but it was really hollow because all I was feeling was that missing spot at the Baja 1000. And my race engineer, Mike Kraft, and my racing partner, Bobby Picoy, they're like, we're going to do this. You know, we're going to do this year in 18. And, we did, we won. And there was some extenuating circumstances, you know, there were some penalties, there was this, but we all day long, I never had one doubt in my mind that we were going to win. At mile 100, we lost first gear, which also lost reverse. So we're at mile 110 and I'm radioing through the satellite radio telling my race partner at mile 350, who's going to get in the truck, Pat Dean. I'm like, hey, it's up to you. I don't know what your course looks like, but the truck is perfect. We're running in the top five. You decide if you want to change the transmission or not. If you change the transmission, then we're racing for 10th. And I got to the pit. I never asked again. He jumped in the car and took off, brought it back to us in the top three. And we had heard about all these penalties and things that had been going on. There had been a lot of changes at SCORE with trying to get us everybody to settle down in some segments. And I just raced to exactly what I thought I needed to do. And we were fortunate at the end of the day to be the winner of the Baja 1000 and accomplish that goal. And the question you asked me was about my dad. And we had my dad's ashes ride with us in the race car, and we never told anybody, we never said anything that he was in there until the finish line, you know. And obviously the emotion was there. There's actually a really great photo someone took with my head is on the steering wheel, and you can see the Baja, my helmet has the Baja 1000 map painted on it. And just that pure emotion, that exhaustion, that relief that we were able to accomplish that goal was mind-boggling. And to be able to have my dad with us on that journey was an honor. But, you know, as everybody knows, having your dad actually there would have been the real topper of it all. But at the end of the day, the Baja 1000 overall winner trophy is downstairs right next to my dad's ashes that are in our showroom. And you know, that was our quest, and we were able to achieve it. Did we retire on the podium? No. No, our goal is to win the peninsula run. So we were really keyed for this year, which was supposed to be a peninsula run. The SCORE has since changed it.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to wait till next year to prove our might on the peninsula run in 2021.
And can you fathom what a peninsula run solo would have been like for those guys who did it?
I've done it, so I understand it. I didn't have success. We actually had a terrible day. We were we were having our second nighttime at Scorpion Bay. We were the very last pit at San Juanico. The sweep helicopter flew over us about 20 miles before that. We ended up not making it past Loretto. I ended up being up for over 52 hours. I actually drove the chase truck into La Paz. Everybody else was smoked. But I felt great. But yeah, the people that have won on a peninsula run, I have tons of respect for. The thing about a peninsula run is if you have a great, perfect day, it's not that crazy because you're not getting out of the car. You're not dealing with stress. You're not taking your helmet or goggles off or opening your visor. You know, if you have a straight run through, it's still crazy at 20 hours or whatever, but it's not as hard as if you solo it and finish 10th, mm-hmm. in my opinion. But those that have soloed it, Ivan Stewart or, you know, all these different heroes and legends that have done that, my hat's off to them. It's a great accomplishment. My goal always was to do it on a motorcycle, to race it solo on a dirt bike. But the problem is my job is to race in a trophy truck, and I couldn't figure out how I was going to beat the trophy truck to Cabo or La Paz and then get back and get in the trophy truck before the finish line. Or the truck's going to pass the bike eventually.
Hey, can we talk about trophy trucks for a second?
We can. I love talking about trophy trucks. I don't like talking about what it costs to keep them going, but I love talking about trophy
that.
Trucks.
No, we're not going to discuss that.
You can discuss it. I don't care. I'm trying to find the money is a whole other thing.
Yeah, you know, the name of my show is Slow Baja, and that's my approach. And I'm, you know, on the dirt in my old Land Cruiser, I'm doing 35, 40. My eyeballs are jiggling out, and right. I'm starting to get scared. So on trophy trucks, I'm going to quote you here. Once I get over 120 miles per hour, the truck feels like it's going to take off and fly. And at times you can really and truly be going that fast and be driving sideways and almost floating sideways down the dirt.
True.
I'm just.
Trophy trucks are not built aerodynamically, so to speak. So all the coolers are in the back window, right? So the cab's open. So as you get up and over 120 miles an hour, that air is coming inside the cab and you're getting a degree of lift. I haven't felt it recently, but back when I raced with Pistol Pete Sorin, God rest his soul, I felt the truck completely sideways at 126 miles an hour. Not completely sideways, but I felt it drifting sideways when we're going in a straight line. And you can't lift off the throttle because then it's going to collapse that side of the suspension. So you got to kind of nurse it back. But true, it feels sometimes like it's going to fly.
Is it like an airboat? Are you like Marlon Perkins and those old Mutual of Omahas on some airboat across the Everglades?
Well, the weird thing about the difference is the airboat doesn't have anything above your head, really. So you're not capturing that wind. When you're inside the cab of the trophy truck, you're capturing all that. You're in this like spinning vortex of air. And really, that's one of the things that makes you the most tired is all that air up against your body all day long. Because you're, you know, whatever, no matter what you're doing, you're not sitting back in the seat, right? You're up. So you're holding your neck up against the wind all day long and against all the bumps. But the feeling at 120 is pretty spectacular. You start going upwards of over 135 and then it starts to get more scary. 120 is like exhilarating kind of fun, but over that you're like, okay, it's getting pretty crazy.
Is there a wave?
You don't want to crash anything at that speed.
No. Is there a wave equivalent? Is 120 6 feet and it's just lovely and over that is 12 feet and you're going to get hurt?
120 is like, you know, feathering second reef pipe day where you like can catch the wave and you can kind of do a turn up into the barrel and it's still gnarly, like crazy gnarly, but it's not super scary. And 135 is like third reef's capping and second reef is like gonna, you don't know where it's gonna come across and drill you, you know. It's definitely far more, I mean, it's crazy. Just that 15 miles an hour makes a huge difference.
Well, let's take a quick break right here. We'll be right back with Cameron Steele at Baja HQ. Here at Slow Baja, we can't wait to drive our old Land Cruiser south of the border. And when we go, we'll be going with Baja Bound Insurance. Their website's fast and easy to use. Check them out at BajaBound.com. That's BajaBound.com, serving Mexico travelers since 1994.
Hey, Baja tourism is picking up, and our friends at the Animal Pad and TAP Act want to remind you, when you're crossing the border, just say no to puppy peddlers. I know they're cute, but the sooner we can end the demand, we can end the supply. For more information, check out theanimalpad.org and TAP Act on Instagram and Facebook.
I'm going to transition here and ask about the most successful racer in the Steele family. Tell me about your wife, Heidi.
Isn't she amazing? You know, the amazing stat is that she'd never been camping or dirt biking before we got together. And people always ask, did you meet racing? No, we didn't meet racing. In fact, really when we met, I wasn't racing because I was just coming out of the death of my mother and our family had not been racing. And, you know, our family was basically destitute. That's a whole different story. You know, we didn't have much going on. I was working as a car salesman like my dad had when he was younger. And somewhere in there, I got offered a job at a surf magazine by my friend Scott Picard. And I was at a trade show in San Diego. And this girl that I'd met about 8 years before happened to be there. And I was like, dang, there's my Baja girl right there. You know, my love of my life. And so in a whirlwind relationship, you know, we ended up, started dating in September, engaged in December, bought a house in February, moved in April, married in August.
Wow.
22 years later plus. But she's just amazing. You know, I've always believed that anybody that puts their mind to something can do anything they want. And one thing Heidi said early on, we were racing in 2003, and she's like, you know, I don't want to just go to the races and be a cheerleader. I want to race. So we had bought a car as a pre-runner and I had decked it out for her. And in 2004, I believe she did her first race. It was a sportsman class and it wasn't really a big deal, but she did win her class. She also got disqualified because we entered her in the wrong class. She ended up going to the SCORE Baja 500 next in 2004 with some of my neighborhood kids, Justin Smith, who's grown up to be a very famous racer, and Cody Stewart, who's still my navigator to this day. They're my neighborhood kids. They were 15 or whatever when we moved in. And they won the Baja 500, they won the Baja 1000, and they won the championship in sportsman. And I'm like, well, you can't race sportsman anymore. You won the championship. Now what? We bought a Ford Ranger 7S truck. She went out the first race at San Felipe. We lost the transmission early, so I got to come up on what I thought was a truck upside down. I found out it was my truck that was upside down, my wife driving. She's like, will you drive it out of here? I'm like, no, you're going to drive it out of here. And from that day forward, she's just really always handled it. She ended up winning the Class 7 SX Championship in SCORE and the 7100 Championship in Best in the Desert, 2008 Dirt Sports Driver of the Year. Went on to win, I believe, two or three other championships in the unlimited midsize truck. So once we won in the midsize limited truck, we're like, well, we got to move on. And she ended up winning, I believe, four Baja 1000s in her class with her partner, Renee Brueger, and other people that had helped her along the way. Renee was the staple there the entire time. Jamie Campbell was a part of it, Timmy Lawrence. But she just loved it so much. And eventually we talked to the sponsors. And by 2013, she was racing trophy truck. It was a little bit tough because now we had a daughter born in 2012. And it was fun. She raced, and her and Jessica McMillan teamed up. They finished in the top 10 in a few trophy truck races. They actually finished in 2013. I believe they were sixth in the SCORE championship points, which was a huge accomplishment. The next year, they didn't have as much luck in 2014. And then my wife, I suggested she go to another race to practice to, you know, just have some fun racing away from SCORE so there's less pressure. She had a big crash. Ended up with a concussion. We didn't talk a lot about it, but she was out of racing for a couple years. And then, you know, kids take over and stuff like that. But she'll be coming back next year. We've been rebuilding that very same Ranger for her. But she's she's opposite of me. She's got multiple degrees. She's got her MBA. She owns her own human resource consulting firm. She used to be the president of the National Human Resource Association for a couple years. And she's just 5'8", blonde hair, looks very, not diminutive, not small, but she doesn't look like the kind of person that you would say, oh, she's tromping around in Baja. She's walking around in a business suit and heels, you know, on her call with her glasses on, and you're like, this is the same woman that wins the Baja 1000. It's pretty crazy, but she's amazing. I love her. Sometimes we got to brawl a little bit for fun, but she's a pretty good spark plug. I'll tell you, she's a great mom too.
And you've got two kids now?
We do. Kay is 8 and a half, and we have a newborn. She's 11 months. Wow. And she was born. Yeah, so we were talking about getting pregnant. We're like, okay, well, let's make sure we don't get pregnant where the baby's going to come for the Baja 1000. So we kind of tried to set it up for Christmas baby. And she was due December 7th, and she came on November 11th, like 2 weeks before the Baja 1000. So it's kind of crazy. She's always going to have me, at least while I'm racing, talking about Baja while her birthday is coming up. But she ended up in the hospital for three or so weeks, you know, in the NICU because she was premature. She's only 4 pounds when she was born, 4.3. And she's just amazing. And her older sister loves her. And it's been a great, you know, COVID's been very tough for everybody. And I'm very sorry for people who have lost their lives. And we've been very, very careful. But during being very, very careful for 100 days of lockdown at our house, our 8-year-old got to be the big sister to our newborn, you know, sister. And it's been really spectacular.
That's amazing. We're not here to talk about me, but I share the NICU experience. It's a tough one to go through. But my twins were there for a month. And my son, who is 3.5 pounds, you know, is a strapping 6'1" rower,
right?
You know, healthy and smart and vibrant, and it's tough while you're in it, and it's an amazing when you're out of it. And I just knock wood that my kids are super healthy, and you know, it's the most important thing in life.
For so sure. Before
we start crying together here, Cameron, I'm just going to say, can you describe the violence of driving a trophy truck? Horsepower, wheel travel, top speed, and now, you know, we touched on it a little bit, but what does that do to you?
The trophy truck, it's funny. People that race other classes are like, oh, you drive a trophy truck, it's super smooth all day long. It's like
cushy,
a marshmallow.
Bro. It's cushy.
Yeah, it's like racing in a couch. It's like floating on marshmallows.
Right.
Well, whatever you do in the limited car and you take that beating, that pounding, just multiply that by the speed, because really in the San Felipe Whoops, other people are going 30, 40, maybe 50, and they're getting beat, right? Well, the trophy truck, yes, we're skimming across the top of most of it, but we're going 90 miles an hour or 85 miles an hour in the Whoops, and it is brutal. It is a hell of a ride in there. And yes, we have more or less 25 inches of front wheel travel and 33 inches of rear wheel travel, 40-inch BF Goodrich tires and big Fox shocks, but it's just multiplied from what the lower classes feel. You know, if you drive a trophy truck at 70%, then you're driving a marshmallow floating around all day long. But if you're driving it at 85%, you're in a violent, smashing cockpit. The intensity inside the truck is incredible. And, you know, you're always watching out all day long because you're going so fast. You're always watching to make sure no one's moving in your peripheral. You know, someone's not accidentally moving a car or someone's walking or whatever, you know, because the fans are all over out there. And sometimes I don't think they realize how fast that truck's going. The other thing that the fans probably don't realize is the truck doesn't just stay right in a straight line all the time. It kind of drifts around a little bit. And so I always said that if the fans had any idea what it was like being inside the trophy truck, they wouldn't stand so close to the race course. But so you just got to be careful around all the people, which we're very careful. But it is a lot of work in there. It's not for the faint of heart. I mean, you're really going fast. There's a lot of risk. One wrong move could end up, I mean, like I said, you don't want to crash at 120 miles an hour. And just taking in everything that the truck's doing and giving it back the input and making sure you're not hurting it is a pretty incredible experience, but at the same time, incredibly violent.
And the mental focus must be astonishing.
It's so crazy. The mental part of it is staggering. I mean, first of all, you got to prep to get ready for the race, all the pre-running, and you know, a lot of people laughing, whatever. But if you're one of those top 10 teams, you're razor sharp focused on what you're doing all the time. And when you get inside the racetrack, I mean, you're really all day long trying to drive the truck quickly. You're not going as fast as you can. If you go as fast as the truck can go, you'll destroy it. It just, you can't do it all day long. But you run a pace, and you're managing what the other drivers are doing, the data you're getting from your team, or, you know, you can see what the other teams have been doing by how their pit crew is set up when you go by them, whether they're breaking down or they're setting up, or if they're sitting there ready to fuel the truck, you know, they're close. So you're kind of mitigating all day long. And then on top of that, you're making sure that the truck isn't getting damaged, and you're holding it right down the race course line, and you're hitting all of the spots you want to hit on the race course to make sure you're not hitting the spots you don't want to hit. And yeah, it's mentally intensive. I mean, usually the week after the Baja 1000, thankfully, is Thanksgiving, and you can kind of like just pause for a second. But, you know, you get out of the race truck and people are like, you know, they're all geared up, ready to like, excited and stuff. And you're just like, oh, you know, mentally exhausted.
What trust do you have in your navigator?
100%. You got to trust him 100%.
It's got to be.
Yeah.
You can't drive that by sight. You got to have.
You drive by sight.
At a competitive level.
Yeah. You have to have great information, and the information has to be delivered well. I mean, I think you can still compete in a single seat situation, but I don't think you're going to be as good because your navigator isn't just giving you navigation. They're doing all the truck diagnostic along the way. They're doing all the communications with the team. So I have an isolation switch. I should requote that. Cody, my navigator, has an isolation switch. He pushes the button. I can't hear anything outside. All I can hear is him talking to me. And so he's managing the entire truck and the navigation and the communications and me, right? Because the driver, you know, you get up and down like, oh, I made a mistake there or whatever, which I normally don't do. I don't dwell on something that like I missed a turn a little bit or I hit a hole or whatever. But your navigator's your psychotherapist.
Yeah, he's pumping you up.
Yeah, or bringing you down.
Or bringing you down, yeah.
Right? Because he's trying to manage the entire race. And that's one of the things, you know, people think, oh, yeah, I got a navigator that can change a tire real fast, and I got a navigator that can read the GPS. But that's really, I mean, the tire changing is important, but when you race on BFGs, shameless sponsor plug, you don't change them as often. Cody, I would stack up as one of the best tire changers in the business. But really, it's the in-car game and beforehand understanding what it's going to take. Now, when we go out and pre-run, we know exactly what we're looking for and how to do it. I mean, Cody and I have been together inside that truck for 12 years now. And, you know, unfortunately, we had a big incident where Cody was injured severely, but he's been able to get back in the truck. And, you know, those kind of things, you know, weigh on you. But he's never missed a beat. You know, he took a year off and recovered and is back in the truck, and it's been great. So I love, you know, I always say, as long as Cody's navigating and Renee's building my truck, we're all good. We can keep racing. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, let's pivot there. We're going to wrap up here because you've been super generous, making some time for me. Tell me about your personal connection to the people of Baja. I know you're tight with the orphanage Rancho Santa Marta. That's legit. Tell me about your connection to the people and some of the folks that live large in your life.
Well, I think that, like I said, the people are what make Baja, you know? So I have connections with different people that I've met along the way. Whether it's the electrician Aaron that lives in Ensenada, who became a great friend of my dad's, we made a connection with, or the owner of the San Nicolas Hotel, Nico.
Nico Saad.
Yeah, a great ambassador, but also, you know, a gentleman we met through there is just a spectacular person who's always helped us. You know, I mean, there's people all over the peninsula. You know, unfortunately, in the last couple of years, one of Baja's greatest ambassadors passed away. Poncho at San Rafael Fish Camp was maybe possibly the greatest ambassador Baja's ever had. He loved where he lived. He loved what he did. He didn't have a car that ran. He had a dog. And he relied on people bringing him food. And yes, the military comes by, and yes, the fishermen or the people that pack the fish there at San Rafael would also, you know, contribute. But he was always smiling and so stoked to see you pull up. And one of my greatest things that I've ever received in Baja, you know, after the Odile hurricane, we formed a group, Off-Roader Hurricane Relief, and we raised along with Talbot Vildosa and his family, Mexicana Logistics, and Ryan Geez, drawing blanks all of a sudden. I'm thinking about Poncho, but we got together and sent truckloads of material down there, you know, water, supplies.
Yeah, I think that's Ryan Thomas.
Ryan Thomas, sorry, yeah. I can't believe, I couldn't believe Ryan.
It's all right.
I remember Ryan's name. Tim Sanchez was involved, and the late Oscar Ramos, amongst others. But we took some supplies to places that weren't going to get a semi-truck in. The road to LA Bay was blown out. We went there, and we also had a few truckloads set up and ready to go to El Barrio and San Francisco. The road had been, you know, pretty much destroyed in a couple spots. And right before Poncho's place at San Rafael, the road was all blown out, full of mud. The river had taken over. And, you know, he was probably, I would say, a mile and a half from there. But he had heard our trucks coming down the rocks on the hill before, about 3 miles from his house. And he had walked out into the, to find out who was out there. And he had not seen a human. And he's like, yes, I'll show you how to get around. So we had four trucks. We elected to take two, fill them with supplies. We hand carried them across all the mud, reloaded the trucks. We went to Poncho's. And then we asked, you know, Poncho about his experience with Odile. And he said he had never been so scared in his life. And he told us, I believe, through Ryan Thomas, that he had stayed in a grave marker. He had got inside the brick marker, and for the big gnarliest part of the storm, and
gives me shivers.
He said we were the first people. He said there was a rancher that came by for a ranch further away, but we were the first people to come to check on him, and we took him with us to El Barrio. We actually arrived, believe it or not, the trucks from the Mexican government were pulling into the fork into El Barrio as we pulled in from the other fork. And we were going to be ahead of them. We're like, well, we'll go with you. And so we dispersed all supplies. Poncho was so proud to be able to be a part of that and take that to those people. Well, anyway, the number one thing that I ever received in my life, other than my kids, was there's a carved cascavera, I believe it is, a rattlesnake, carved out of wood that hangs above our entryway inside of our shop here at Baja HQ. And after that Odile experience, we came back the next year on one of our trips and visited Poncho. And he saw me, and his eyes lit up. And instead of running to me, he went running back into his house. And he came out with this stick, this staff. And it was something that he had found, this piece of wood. And he carved this rattlesnake and put the two eyes in it. And he's like, I made this for you. And I told Poncho, I said, Poncho, we're going to open a new store, new business, and this is going to hang in my office with pride forever. And I'll bring you a picture to show you. And I decided to put it over the entryway because it's such an important piece of our Baja Stoke. And so every person that walks into Baja HQ unknowingly walks underneath it. But to the side, there's a picture of Poncho and I together the day he gave it to me.
Wow.
And the story. But you walked in today and you saw it, but it doesn't resonate because you don't know the story. But so that's one of my proudest gifts. And Poncho passed away 2 years ago now. We're going on one of our trips coming up, I believe, on Rift Cabo. We're going to put a marker up for Poncho at San Rafael Fish Camp because we'll never forget his hospitality, his stoke, his vibe, his openness. He tells a story that one of the biggest land barons had wanted to buy his property. And he said no, but he ended up telling us that we could build our house right next to his if we wanted to. Of course, we didn't take him up on it. We didn't do it. But that's just Poncho. You know, it's just who Poncho is. And, you know, I focused on him. But there's so many great people, whether it's Edith and Carmen at, you know, Edith's or the office in Cabo, or it's Antonio at Baja Cactus and trying to build the fire station in El Rosario. Whether it's the people that run the orphanage at Rancho Santa Marta, or some of the Americans that are doing great things. You know, we've been involved with a food drive in San Felipe. There's a lady named Connie Coates who's just super passionate, who is helping out delivering food to people. And, you know, it's just, there's such exceptional people all over the peninsula. You know, how do you pick just a couple, right?
Right.
You know, it's just, they're just really, really so many great people and so many great places.
Well,
to go.
We're going to leave it there. Tell me, just in closing here, tell me about the business that we're in, Baja HQ, what you do here so people know. Shameless plug, here's your opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, we designed a business around building off-road aftermarket. We do tire and wheel for any vehicle, but we tried to make it more of a community location than just a business. So we've hosted quite a bit of functions here, like when Ricky Brabeck and Casey Curry won the Dakar Rally. That doesn't directly impact us, but we threw a party for them along with some of their sponsors just because it was a great accomplishment. And we feel like we're that community clubhouse. And, you know, our goal here is, of course, to have a business that can sustain itself, but at the same time, have a place that shares that vibe. Share the stoke is our tagline. And that's because we want people, when they walk in, to just be like, this place is cool. It's fun. They're talking off-road. And my goal is to be able to just greet people when they come in and have my guys help them out. And our race team is also half the building, Desert Assassins. So people get to come in and see their trucks being worked on side, you know, not side by side, but across the shop from real trophy trucks. And it's really fun to be able to share that. I don't know, from a business standpoint, you know, if trophy truck racing is very smart, I also don't know if off-road aftermarket's all that smart, but we're having a great time doing it. So I'm super stoked.
Are you able to talk at all about the Ford Bronco that's sitting down
there?
Sure.
Yeah, right, we can talk about it.
Tell me about that. You've got Ford.
We are
Ford putting a truck together, it looks like.
Sponsored from Factory Racing, or from Ford Racing, I should say. So they have engaged us to run the race team aspect of it. We did not build the truck, but we are currently preparing it for the Baja 1000. We started talking to Ford a couple of years ago. They were looking for a team and a builder, and they weren't disclosing what they were doing, but we talked, and we assumed it was going to be trophy truck. And then they came to us with this project, the Bronco project. And I can tell you, we're huge Ford believers, and seeing them work on Bronco and the engineering and the effort they put into it tells you clearly why their Raptor is so successful, because they have passion and they are going to dig into the tiniest little crevasse to make sure everything is perfect. And that's how the race team has been. Unfortunately, you know, we didn't finish the Baja 1000 last year with the Bronco. That was more because it was just very, like, the project didn't start till really late. We never had all the testing and everything. Now we have thousands of miles of testing, and the Bronco is incredible. But I will say, when the Bronco didn't finish last year, it didn't have anything to do with Ford parts. And there are stock parts all over that vehicle. It is absolutely astounding, from the mounting systems to the actual systems themselves. It's so much stock stuff, and it's like, wow, this stuff is really tough. And that's because they engineer it that way. And so the Bronco's here. We're working on it. We don't have people back in the shop really, so you can't really just come see it, but it's getting prepared for the Baja 1000. It's an honor to be a part of it, and looking forward to sharing the driving duties with some great people. Johnny Campbell, who's won the Baja 1000 11 times, is our team manager. Renee Brugger's our lead tech on it. And we have a couple other great people like Kurt LeDuc, Shelby Hall, and Jason Shear from 3-time King of the Hammers, all racing with us. And it's just an incredible opportunity to be able to share that with people.
So are you a modern day Bill Strop building the Baja Bronco?
No, I don't think so. Bill was a creator of, he was more into all aspects of design and build. I would say that, you know, he did what Geyser Brothers and what Desert Assassins is doing together. Geyser built the truck. We're managing the prep and the racing end of it. So, but Bill did all of that. So we haven't ever reached out to the fabrication level or creativity that Bill did. But I did try to get on Bill's team when I was a kid.
You're a smart boy.
Which everybody did, I'm sure. But
sure.
Yeah, I have a lot of respect for Bill and everything that he accomplished, and the people that not only race and prepare and do the logistics, but build their own race vehicles. I really respect that 100%.
Yeah. So if people want to follow along with what you're up to, keep tabs on Baja HQ, what's the best way?
Really the best, Baja HQ does have a website, but really the best way is to follow on our social, Desert Assassins or Baja HQ or Cameron Steele. We're pretty open with our information, and we share quite a bit. We love to interact with our fans. It's not just about the number of people that like our page. It's the number of people that interact with us. We actually shut down our Desert Assassins website. It wasn't as functional as just going from our social media. So But Baja HQ, since it's a proper business, has that that website for people to go to. They can actually shop there and everything. But social is the way to do it.
So they can find you on all the social platforms.
Yep. Yeah. We focus on Instagram and Facebook mostly. There is some other platforms that we use occasionally, but those are the two that we're focusing on mostly. We like the interaction. You know, a lot of people say Facebook's old school, but one thing Facebook's great for is photo sharing. So if you look back at Desert Assassin's page, there's a few times, like, we offered up a Baja Bound insurance t-shirt to the top three photos that were posted, and we had like 176 photos posted. You can't do that on Instagram. So I love that photo sharing interaction that you can have on Facebook. So Desert Assassin's Facebook is a pretty solid place to interact for off-roading.
All right. Well, Cameron Steele, I've enjoyed this interaction. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And We didn't even talk about our kinship with the northern part of California.
Well, so, next time.
Next time.
All right, buddy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, you guys know what to do. Please help us by subscribing, sharing, rating, all that stuff. And if you missed anything, you can find the links in the show notes at slowbaja.com. I'll be back before you know it. And if you want to receive notices on new episodes, please follow Slow Baja on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook for you old folks.